Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
Hello again. This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun with episode 434 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. This is our pre-Halloween special to get you in the mood for that occasion with movies and music. Today on the show, horror movie aficionado Terrence Hannum is back from the dead to share some of his favorite music from the movies ahead of his annual show on WLOY at Loyola University. And our film critics Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro note the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein, the novel, with a look at Frankenstein in film.
It's alive! In the name of God!
So it's a good show to set the mood before we get started with the conversations. Here's Linda DeLibro to tell us about an interesting lineup of film and film discussion at the Parkway Theater in Baltimore.
At 3:30 on Halloween, we're having a special panel to discuss Frankenstein as a literary object and film, and we will have people talking about the science aspects of it and the filmic aspects of it and the literary aspects of it. This is preceded by a screening of Bride of Frankenstein at 2 p.m.
Oh, wow.
And then, the best part, at 6 p.m., there will be a screening of Young Frankenstein.
Oh, I know we're going to spend my afternoon and evening for Halloween.
And
I don't have to be home giving kids candy.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Finally, it has nothing to do with Frankenstein, but there's also a screening, a special screening at the Parkway of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining at 9 p.m.
Well, that's a good Halloween picture, though.
Yeah. So it's an all-day extravaganza of Halloween / Frankenstein.
Excellent
delights.
Ideas.
And the Parkway.
Very
been,
good.
The Parkway's been doing a Kubrick retrospective all fall anyway, so this makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
The Parkway Theater is in Station North at North Avenue and Charles Street. It's just a block away from where we recorded half of today's show. The Johns Hopkins MICA Film Center in the old Center Theater was nice enough to accommodate us for our Roughly Speaking on Film segment. And WLOY at Loyola University made time to record my conversation with Terrence Hannum. Terrence is a musician and a visual artist and a connoisseur of music that gives us the creeps. He's the originator of the Dead Air podcast. And this Halloween, he will again be streaming a radio version of Dead Air on the Loyola University Maryland station WLOY. So Terrence, connoisseur of spooky movie music, what do you have for us this year? Or is there a theme to Dead Air this year? Or?
I think there's...
Like Dead Composers. Last year it was Dead Composers,
yes,
right?
But this year, the Dead Composers, there's two that I wanted to focus on. The first one is Johan Johansson. He did originally the soundtrack for Mandy, which was a new movie, came out this year. And Nicolas Cage is excellent, I thought. I was really impressed. It's not like anything you've ever seen before. For sure.
It sounds like this film has already developed a cult following of some sort.
Yeah, I've heard some interesting facts from people at the Parkway. It was very successful for them. My friends who are kind of in the horror soundtrack world and are really into horror films were really blown away by it.
So Johan Johansson passed away this year?
He passed away, this year or last year. Very young. I think he's like in his 40s.
Mm.
This great body of work. I mean, he's a very accomplished modern composer. He has records on Deutsche Grammophon. Like, he's a really interesting composer. He went for a different thing with the Mandy soundtrack, more of a rock-based. He had my friend Faith does vocals on it. She's in this band called Mammifer. My friend Stephen O'Malley from the doom metal band Sun plays guitar on it. I have some
Don't you need to do a disclaimer of some kind? I have friends who performed in this.
Yeah, but at the same time, I went into it with no expectation.
Hey, what is it about Nicolas Cage?
I don't know.
People think he makes too many movies.
I read there's a really good interview. I think it's with The Guardian, and he said, you know, everyone's trying to be like a photorealist, and I want to be a surrealist. And I think that
he does achieve that.
He's very aware of himself. Yeah. I thought that I appreciated that from an artist kind of being like, I'm not Robert De Niro. I am right. Nicolas Cage, and my goal is something else. And then Mandy, whew, it gets there for sure.
And he has in his body of work a fair number of supernatural type films.
He does,
right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Well, who's the other dead composer we're celebrating?
Well, this guy is named Stelvio Cipriani. He passed away this year, and last year we celebrated Umberto Lenzi, who's kind of a notorious, terrible, low-grade Italian horror director. He passed away. But he made one of my favorite zombie movies. It was called Nightmare City, where it doesn't really make any sense because all the zombies can like use guns and knives and stuff. So it's like, why do they have to be dead? But there's a great soundtrack that Stelvio Cipriani did. He has this really great body of work, and I'm a fan of his soundtracks. And they're very disco oriented, a little bit more exotica, I guess. Kind of. He is very different. He's not like the doomy synth kind of thing I normally like, but I really appreciate what he did. And it's sad, you know, that he's gone, because he also had a really interesting career as a composer, like making orchestral music. So he's a really interesting figure. Nightmare City. In America, it was called City of the Walking Dead, and it had this great VHS box, but it was totally edited down, so it wasn't very gory. But then Quentin Tarantino is a big fan, and he had helped get the DVD redone by, I think, Anchor Bay, and it's just weird.
Would you call that 80s exotica?
It's kind of coming out of like a Italian disco, I think. Like, I think that like 70s Italo disco.
Okay,
thing,
70s.
Yeah, you know, I think that really a lot of these composers, you know, they were having these dual careers of like making a disco track. Like Fabio Frizzi, who did The Beyond, and he was making disco singles, and they're pretty successful, but he was also doing movie soundtracks. And now he's still alive. He tours with a band and will play The Beyond and all these movie soundtracks, because, I mean, he's embraced that this is who he is.
You know, these composers that you celebrate with Dead Air, this is not Hans Zimmer. This is not John Williams.
Yeah.
People like that. It's not Morricone, right?
Not all the time. Well, we have Salvatore Morricone. Like, he did The Thing with John Carpenter, and that's a beautiful score.
That's
really
good. Can we listen to a bit of that?
Yes, absolutely. And
wait a minute, right now.
Yeah.
I need a hit of that. So that's Morricone. But you know what I'm getting at, is the guys you're focusing on, I mean, they're just not as famous as these others. They don't make these big pictures, right?
There's one guy I do want to touch on, Antón García Abril, who refuses to let anyone reissue his soundtracks. He's a Spanish composer. He's a very serious composer, still alive today. He's been asked about reissuing these soundtracks for Tombs of the Blind Dead, and they're great. They're really interesting. He refuses to let it happen. I think he said the tapes are gone. I don't want them out. It's interesting because all these composers have influenced so many other musicians. So many of them had to be economical. Like, John Carpenter had to make a soundtrack with a synthesizer and a drum machine. You know, like, you don't have all this money to pay for Hans Zimmer to come in. You're making a low-budget movie, and you have to be resourceful. And so I think that sound of this, like, using synthesizers and drum machines, it paid off, but it influenced people kind of coming out of punk or whatever at that time in the 70s and into the 80s. If you're watching all the VHS tapes, and you like that sound and that aesthetic, and you realize, oh, I can do this. They did it in a room in, like, 5 minutes to be on this giant movie. I could do that. I could program a drum machine or play a synthesizer. And I think that it's kind of liberating in some way.
What's the scariest piece you have?
Scariest piece
I
have?
Yeah, I mean, if you want people to be streaming WLOY on Halloween evening as kids are coming to the door.
Yeah.
And you're going to, you know, you'll give a setup and then you'll just lay back and let the music play. What would that be?
I would say Colin Stetson is this really great musician. He's known for his work with other bands, but he did the soundtrack for that movie Hereditary, and he used a lot of like saxophones and just makes them into these sound like otherworldly things, and a lot of wind instruments that he's like using through different effects. And it's chilling. I think it's absolutely beautiful and terrifying. But I would say the soundtrack for Hereditary, this year's film, is great.
I want you to reach back and find something cool for us from the archives. Say something from the 70s or 60s. What have you got?
Messiah of Evil is hands down the biggest discovery for me this year, outside of kind of getting the Tombs of the Blind Dead stuff. But Messiah of Evil is a great film. I can't believe I put it off so long from watching it. It has these kind of Romero-esque zombie moments in it. It's really surreal and very artistic. It was shot like in Los Angeles. There's like a little cult around it where people like will find the same shots, but it's supposed to take place in this like small town in Northern California or something. It's a really good movie, and this soundtrack is really cool too. It's really short.
Let's do just a reminder of when we can listen to the full Dead Air.
It'll be on Halloween night at 7 o'clock. So you can play it while the trick-or-treaters are coming to your house. And then at midnight as well, so you can stay really scared into the late night.
You know, your particular genre is horror film.
Yes.
I love movie music. I listen
you're
to movie.
You're a big fan. I know.
Did you know that about me?
I've seen your playlist. Yes, I love it.
It's so good when you pull it away and isolate it and just listen to it on its own. There's some really great stuff that's done for the movies.
I mean, for me, like, I have soundtracks I find that are interesting, or I'm interested in the movie, and then there's always a soundtrack that sticks around. It's one that I'll put on, I'll listen to in my own time, and it's rare, I think, to find one that will have that for you, like where you listen to it disassociated from the film or from thinking about the movie and horror or whatever genre it is. So I'm always impressed when the soundtrack can outlive that.
And there seems to be more opportunity for composers now with streaming, with Amazon original productions, Netflix.
Yeah.
And they have a taste for the supernatural or the bizarre in the programming and in the stories that they're telling.
For
right?
sure. Yeah. I mean, now we have Castle Rock, which I thought was great. I haven't seen The Haunting of Hill House, but I'm a huge fan of Shirley Jackson's book. That's a great book. Yeah, it's been interesting to see that happen. I'm looking forward to the new Twilight Zone. I'm thinking that's going to be great.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that. Do we have another Twilight Zone coming?
From the director from Get Out. Jordan Peele's directing.
And Get Out was on your list last
Get
year
Out
for spooky music.
And again, Get Out was a great soundtrack. It's something I could put on and actually just put it on the background, listen to it, and enjoy it, you know, like a band's album or something. And again, I think that that's a little bit rare, you know, not always something you can get out of a soundtrack. It's so well done, well paced.
And that music. Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you.
Terrence Hannum is a musician and visual artist and a connoisseur of music from horror movies. He's the originator of the Dead Air podcast, and this Halloween, as he mentioned, he'll again be live streaming a radio version of Dead Air on the Loyola University Maryland radio station WLOY. On the 30th and running into the 31st, there's 2 hours of Dead Air and more creepy music with Terrence Hannum at 7 p.m. on the 31st on Halloween. The Baltimore Sun thanks WLOI and operations manager John DeVecca for recording my podcast segment with Terrence. A short break for 2 sponsor messages, and then Frankenfilm with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight. Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes interior designer Patrick Sutton to discuss his new book, Storied Interiors, exploring the relationship between the story we all carry in our mind of what our life might look like, the spaces we live in, and the lifestyle we dream of. Thursday, November 1st at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
So on our pre-Halloween special, we thought with Linda and Chris we'd talk about Frankenstein in film, also noting that this year marks 200 years since the novel was published.
That is correct. Mary Shelley published Frankenstein, or Modern Prometheus, in 1818.
And do we know how many times it has been made into film?
Many. I have an incomplete list with at least 50 titles, some of which are
50
things.
50 titles?
At least, but we're pretty sure that it's in the hundreds. And there are titles like I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, Frankenstein Created Woman. These are lesser titles, and we'll be talking about the early major ones.
Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein?
Indeed, yes. That was 1948, and yeah. That is a worthy comedy horror.
I've been thinking about my own fascination with Frankenstein from when I was a little kid. And at first, I saw him as a monster. But then I realized he wasn't just a monster that was created on his own. Someone created him. And to me, that marked a difference from, say, Creature from the Black Lagoon or, I don't know, some alien space film, right? He was someone that someone created in an attempt to reanimate life. I wasn't as scared of Frankenstein as that. I felt sorry for him. I felt pity for Frankenstein.
Well, and we have to remember that Frankenstein is actually the creator of Frankenstein.
He's the doctor, right.
Yes.
So it's Frankenstein's monster, right?
Exactly. And I think that just highlights how crucial this relationship between creator and created is, and why this story has lasted so long and has such staying power, because it's really a vehicle for exploring ideas about doubleness, the dark side of the human being, of what it means to create. You know, there's a lot of stuff about science. You know, Victor Frankenstein is a scientist, and this story raises a lot of questions about what kinds of people usurp the power of God to create life.
Do you understand what I meant about pity for Frankenstein's monster?
Well, indeed, and in fact, in the book, that is a central element of the sort of latter half of the novel. And it is very much, as Linda's saying, about the dangers of humanity playing God, the hubris of it. And it's interesting to note that Mary Shelley wrote this novel as part of an informal contest with Lord Byron and her lover and eventual husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley. They were in Switzerland, and they were, you know, two men, established writers, and then Mary Shelley, who was barely 18. She was barely out of her teens and was having an affair with this man who I believe was married to someone else at the time. Mm-hmm. And yet it is her product from that contest that we talk of, came, you know, a classic of the early 19th century. And the early 19th century is, of course, you know, the middle of the industrial age and the dawn of the age of chemistry. So everyone thinks that science has unlimited possibilities. And I just love what she did with that book. It's a really creepy, creepy novel and so well written.
When is the first time it becomes a film? Is it in the silent era?
It is in the silent era. I haven't seen any of those silent ones. The first sound picture is the 1931 James Whale adaptation, simply called Frankenstein. I don't know, Linda, have you seen any of those?
Yeah, I saw the 1910 silent film. It's easily available online. And it's interesting because once this story transfers to the cinema, then it becomes all about the actual creation of the monster and the look of the monster, which are two things that the novel actually doesn't deal with very much at all. So you've got the opportunity, even in the silent film, which was an Edison film, for lots of, you know, flashing lights and bubbling and
arc lamps.
Yeah, smoke and
right. Mm-hmm.
And then the creature has a lot of wild hair, and he's really hideously ugly. And so there are a lot of pyrotechnics.
Does the Frankenstein, does the monster from that film that you're describing look anything like the Karloff that we see later?
No, okay. Except that he's hideous and people are terrified of him.
Because, I mean, the Karloff Frankenstein's monster is so iconic.
Absolutely. I mean, it's become the template on which, you know, all future iterations of the monster, you know, follow. Of course, we said that Frankenstein is the name of the doctor, not of the monster, but eventually everyone forgets that and Frankenstein just becomes the monster.
Where do we start?
Well, let's start with that 1931 James Whale film where he more or less introduced the world to the actor who had taken on the stage name of Boris Karloff. And Colin Clive, who's playing Dr. Frankenstein, has just created his monster.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
In the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
I'm sorry, I laugh a little bit now when you hear that. But I remember for the first time, it was just so exciting. I think I actually can remember that. Sometime when I was a kid in the 60s, monsters were big. These films weren't into revival. They were on TV a lot. Local TV stations had like horror film hours on Saturdays or Saturday nights. And you could get plastic models of the monsters and glue them together. And I did it for Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and Frankenstein. And then I started taking the film seriously. You know, I started like really paying attention to the story, and I was so enthralled.
At first, in the 50s, you have this phenomenon that's terrifying at first. You know, these whale films, you know, the second one is a little campier, Bride of Frankenstein, than the first one. But the monster is still really scary. And then in the 50s and 60s, well, even with Abbott and Costello, you have this sort of
campy.
Yeah, it turns campy, and the more comedic it gets, the more it blunts the edge of the horror effect. And
absolutely.
I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I certainly agree with what you said about Bride of Frankenstein with Elsa Lanchester's, you know, wonderful Bride of Frankenstein with that gray streak through her hair. And then in Bride of Frankenstein, the monster finally can talk. But just a quick word, you know, in the 1930s, every studio sort of developed its area of specialization for which it was known. And Universal is the studio that produced all these relatively low budget for their time horror films. Mm-hmm. There was more than just Frankenstein. There was The Mummy. There was Dracula. There was The Wolfman. There was The Invisible Man. Invisible Man also directed by James Whale. I've never been a huge horror fan, but I do like these because with the remove of history, I don't find them that frightening. I find them just kind of fun. You know?
And they're fascinating. One of the interesting things about the Universal horror films is that the personnel who made them are populated by the Europeans who came over fleeing Hitler's Germany. And there is a very strong German Weimar influence on many of them. I mean, James Whale was British, but he clearly took his lessons from that pre-war German cinema, which flourished in the 20s and brought us classics like Nosferatu. So you see these really gorgeous atmospherics, very expressionist renderings of nature, and you still have some of those same ideas about the dangers of mob rule, which I also find very interesting. Then, you know, there are lots of torches and pitchforks and angry villagers, and it really is kind of Nazi-like. And since this is 1931 and 35, this is definitely an undercurrent in these films.
Definitely. And I just want to say, speaking of Weimar Republic cinema, so if you look at the 1920 The Golem, you can see directly where James Whale got his imagery and his you know, his mise-en-scène and aesthetic from.
I want to defend a little bit Frankenstein because of what's happening there. He's trying to reanimate a dead person, and then he succeeds in doing that. And then that person is, you know, a confused being living in the world and trying to get by and trying to understand his surroundings and the people around him. And they take no mercy on him. And he becomes attacked by a mob. And yet he tries to communicate with a little girl. He tries to communicate with a blind man. And
I was very moved by it. So I have an emotional attachment to Frankenstein more than I realized until I started thinking about this show we're doing.
No, I think that's right. It's the misunderstood monster, yeah, which becomes a very familiar trope in Hollywood. And I think that's where the ambivalence comes from in our own perception of these films, that we are feeling terrified ourselves, but also very sympathetic at the same time.
There is a moment in that first 1931 film where Victor Frankenstein talks to Van Helsing, his sort of scientific colleague who's concerned about, I think he's his mentor actually, who's concerned very much about what he's just done. And they talk very much about this nature of humans creating creatures and playing God.
You never wanted to look beyond the clouds and the stars, or to know what causes the trees to bud, and what changes a darkness into light. But if you talk like that, people call you crazy. Well, if I could discover just one of these things, what eternity is, for example, I wouldn't care if they did think I was crazy.
You're young, my friend. Your success has intoxicated you. Wake up and look facts in the face. Here we have a fiend whose brain
must be given time to develop. It's a perfectly good brain, Doctor. Well, you ought to know. It came from your own laboratory.
The brain that was stolen from my laboratory was a criminal brain.
Oh, well, after all, it's only a piece of dead tissue.
Only evil can come of it. Your health will be ruined if you persist in this madness.
I'm astonishingly sane, Doctor.
You have created a monster and it will destroy you.
Patience, patience. I believe in this monster, as you call it. And if you don't, well, you must leave me alone.
Now, when we get to Bride of Frankenstein, Elsa Lanchester.
She is frightening.
She
is. Once this female monster is actually brought to life, she scares the bejesus not only out of me, the viewer, but out of Frankenstein's original monster, who then decides to blow himself and herself up. In this film, inexplicably, nobody tells us how this happened. The monster, whom we saw die at the end of the first film, is not dead, and there's a sort of little prologue that shows how he escaped. And inexplicably, he now talks. And
he talks in this film? I have to see it again, I guess.
And we see him. He's running away.
How does he talk?
Actually, Linda, you did a great noise earlier.
Oh. That's not talking.
He talks too.
Yes, and he runs across this blind man in a hut who teaches him how to speak and also how to smoke.
Excuse me, that's not in the original Frankenstein?
No speaking. It's in Bride of Frankenstein.
The blind man scene?
Is in Bride of Frankenstein.
Which is later parodied in Young Frankenstein.
That is correct. And yes, he teaches him more than just how to speak. He teaches him how to appreciate the finer things in life, including a cigar.
And now for our lesson. Remember, this is bread. Bread.
Bread.
And this is wine to drink.
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 Good. Good.
We are friends, you and I. Friends.
Friends.
Good.
Good.
And now for a smoke. No. This is good. Smoke. You try.
Smoke. Good. Good.
Good. I'm sorry, but I can't think of that scene without thinking of Gene Hackman and Peter Boyle in Young Frankenstein, Frankenstein, so many years later, the Mel Brooks film. I guess I'm getting ahead of ourselves here.
Well, yeah, because I agree. That's a wonderful parody, that entire film. But yeah, no, this film, once the bride is created, and Elsa Lanchester, all she does is hiss, and she really does scare me, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, it is scary, and she's only on the screen for minutes, if that. But the other interesting thing is there's a little prologue to the film where she plays Mary Shelley sitting around talking with Lord Byron and Percy Shelley and about how sweet little Mary could possibly come up with this hideous creation.
That's in the movie?
Yeah.
I gotta go see that again. All right.
We do have a clip from the end of the film where you hear her brief hiss, and at this point, the Frankenstein's monster, who now is possessed of speech and has learned from the blind man, returns to the castle where Victor Frankenstein just can't seem to stop reanimating dead tissue, and sees how evil she is and says, "Go!" and blows up the tower.
Look out! The lever! Get away from that lever! You'll blow us all to atoms!
Henry! I hear the door! Henry!
Get back! Get back!
I want to let you come!
But I can't leave them! I can't!
Yes! Go! You live! Go! You stay! We belong dead!
Big finish there.
Indeed. Yeah. Big explosion.
Yeah. What do we have next then?
Well, then we've got all these other sort of, you know, various iterations of Frankenstein through the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Any good ones? The ones that you would recommend that we watch again?
No.
None? What about when we get up to, the 21st century and there's Kenneth Branagh and then there's Robert De Niro? And what about those?
Branagh's version, he's attempting to make it more faithful to Mary Shelley's novel, and it's just a little over the top.
It is. I was, as a kid, I really liked this film now called, I don't know if it had this full title then, but it called Frankenstein, The True Story from 1973, starring Leonard Whiting. And there the monster looks nothing like Boris Karloff. He looks like somebody made of dead tissue. And it's an early Jane Seymour role. She's actually a woman that Victor Frankenstein also brings back to life, and then the monster doesn't like her. And I remember this vivid scene where he pulls her head off. But this is for network TV, so you didn't see all these details. And then, as in the book, there's a scene that ends in the Arctic that really made a vivid impression on me as a kid. Sort of
and
made
again,
an impression
Chris,
on me.
That title is what?
Frankenstein, The True Story.
Story.
That is fine.
So this Halloween, if you want a good scare from a Frankenstein film, which one would you watch? The De Niro one was pretty strong.
Well, yeah, I mean, that sure. I mean, because the problem was that with some of these older films is that to a modern audience they can feel dated, and maybe right. They're interesting cinematically, but perhaps not that frightening. But I do think that the ending of Bride of Frankenstein is still pretty scary because of Elsa Lanchester's performance as the bride.
Okay.
And I do like the 1973 Frankenstein, The True Story, just because it's pretty creepy, though it has that sort of television aesthetic of the early 70s.
Okay.
But if you want a good laugh...
My name, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
So we get to Young Frankenstein. I mean, is there a better parody film?
Of like direct simultaneous parody and homage, I think this is one of the best of
it
its
is.
Time.
It really is. Yeah. So please treat us to a few clips.
So we have Gene Wilder, who plays Dr. Frankenstein, and we should probably just go ahead and go to that clip right away at the beginning of the film. He's giving a lecture in class, and Bud Cort, famous for Harold and Maude, plays a student who asks him a question and is immediately corrected on the pronunciation of his last name.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
I have one question, Dr. Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein.
I beg your pardon?
My name. It's pronounced Frankenstein.
But aren't you the grandson of the famous Dr. Victor Frankenstein, who went into graveyards, dug up freshly buried corpses, and transformed dead components into...
Yes! 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 We all know what he did. But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science and not because of my accidental relationship to a famous cuckoo.
So then it's off to the castle, right?
Then it's off to the castle, where the film follows very much the plot of the original film, except it does mix in elements from The Bride of Frankenstein, too, because you have Gene Hackman playing the blind man at one point. Once the monster takes off, the monster is played by Peter Boyle. Terry Garr plays Frankenstein's assistant, and Marty Feldman plays Igor, not Igor, but Igor.
whose hump his hunch.
Changes sides.
Changes sides on his back.
Indeed, yeah.
Also, Cloris Leachman.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Don't forget Cloris Leachman.
How can one forget Cloris
Leachman? Frau Brucke?
So there's this, you know, as a good parody, there is a moment, although it doesn't happen right after the monster is brought down from lightning because he's not quite animated at that point. But there's a brief pause, and then we return when Linda, perhaps you could do the noise again.
Ooh.
Right. So they hear that coming from the basement, and they rush down, and the monster's alive, and Gene Wilder's Frankenstein cannot contain his excitement.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Oh, my God. I love this movie. I think this is what I'll watch on Halloween. Okay. And you have one more clip?
Indeed. So the film, one of the things I do like about this film is it's not just a direct copy parody. There are original elements. And there's this moment in the film where Gene Wilder and Peter Boyle put on a show because Gene Wilder's Frankenstein decides to demonstrate how civilized his monster is. Mm-hmm. And
He's turned him into Fred Astaire, basically.
He's basically trying to turn him into Fred Astaire, and dressed in top hat and tails, they dance to Puttin' on the Ritz.
Ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, Damen und Herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it!
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper. Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or Umbrellas in their mitts.
Linda DeLibero is the Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Chris Reed is Chair and Professor of the Film and Moving Image Department at Stevenson University. And with Linda, he's a regular contributor to Roughly Speaking. Chris and Linda join us once a month to talk about the movies, both classic film and the current cinema. I hope you enjoyed today's show, and you'll review it on your podcast app if you get a chance. And please support our sponsors. Special thanks to the staff at the Johns Hopkins Mica Film Center for making a recording studio available to us, and we're grateful for the assistance of Jonathan Paris Santana. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. For my producers, Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. We'll see you again soon, and have a great Halloween.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes the writing collective Unruly Catholic Women Writers for a reading and discussion of their new anthology, Unruly Catholic Nuns, Sister Stories. Sister Stories explores the voices of current and former Catholic nuns, and by doing so, contributes to the global conversation about the role of women in the Catholic Church today. Sunday, October 28th at 5 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.